Favorite nuclear family.
My name is Aiden.
And this is Ella.
And you're listening to The Only Show.
Beat Banter.
On CFRC Radio.
Beat
Banter.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC, 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. From New York, this is Democracy Now! FBI says it's not found a link between the New Orleans and Las Vegas New Year's Day attacks. Both men served in the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. The New Orleans man was an Army veteran in the military for a decade. The Vegas suspect was an active duty Green Beret described as an ardent Trump supporter. We'll look at what we know and don't know, and at incoming President Trump's record on homegrown terrorism. Then, three films directed by Palestinians are shortlisted for the Academy Awards. We'll look at one of them, From Ground Zero, a collection of 22 short films made by people in Gaza surviving Israel's bombings and brutal blockade.
No to injustice, no to violence, no to the violation of human rights. No to everything that goes against humanity, joy, life. No to everything that destroys our hopes.
We'll speak with From Ground Zero's curator, the renowned Palestinian filmmaker Rashid Mashrawi, as the film is set to be released today in theaters across the United States. And we'll get an update on the impact of Israel's war on Gaza in Yemen and the U.S. strikes on Yemen in the last days. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli attacks in Gaza have killed at least 35 Palestinians since dawn, with authorities reporting more than 70 civilians killed over the past 24 hours, including this in the so-called humanitarian safe zone of Al-Mawasi. This comes as the Palestinian rights group Al-Haq published a new report called How to Hide a Genocide, revealing how Israel uses evacuation orders and safe zones to obfuscate what it calls its genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip. Al-Haq writes, quote, with insufficient space, shelter, sanitation, facilities, food or water sources, and medical care, these safe zones are intentionally designed to ensure the destruction of all life sheltering there. What's more, the safe zones are routinely targeted by Israeli occupying forces by air, land, and sea, they wrote. As the relentless attacks on Gaza continue, Israeli negotiators are reportedly heading back to Qatar to resume ceasefire talks. Here in New York, the UN Security Council is holding an emergency meeting today to discuss Israeli attacks on Gaza hospitals, including northern Gaza's Kamal Edwan Hospital, whose director, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, was abducted last week by Israeli forces. Israel has since refused to confirm his location or his condition. Medical workers around the world have been calling for his release and for the protection of Gaza's crumbling health infrastructure. Reports on the ground in Gaza say the Israeli military is ordering the forced evacuation of Indonesian hospital, where a handful of patients that were forced out of Kamal Adwan are now being treated. Al Jazeera also reports Israeli forces are intensively shelling the vicinity of Al-Adha Hospital in central Gaza. Palestinian authorities warn 3,500 children are at risk of death due to severe malnutrition. 22% of Gaza's population is currently facing catastrophic levels of acute food insecurity. This is the displaced mother of a sick baby being treated at a UN facility in Deir al-Balah.
The reason behind my daughter's condition is displacement. We fled from the north to Rafah
and then to Deir al-Balah, where we lived in a tent. My daughter's fever would reach 40 degrees daily. We took her to the American hospital every day because of the fever, and they would prescribe paracetamol before sending us away. Her malnutrition worsened due to prolonged displacement, lack of food, and financial hardship since my husband's work stopped during the war.
New Orleans' famed Bourbon Street opened for business Thursday, one day after a man crashed his pickup truck into crowds of New Year's revelers, killing at least 14 people before he was shot dead by police. Investigators now believe the assailant, the 42-year-old Shamsuddin Jabbar of Houston, Texas, acted alone. He served in the U.S. Army for over a decade, including at North Carolina's Fort Liberty, previously known as Fort Bragg. The FBI says he was inspired by the Islamic State and pledged his allegiance to the group in Facebook videos just hours before the attack. Authorities say he'd expressed plans to harm his family by gathering relatives for a celebration before deciding to attack Bourbon Street instead. The FBI has identified the driver of the Tesla Cybertruck that exploded outside the Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas Wednesday morning. Investigators say 37-year-old Matthew Leivelsberger of Colorado Springs died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head moments before his rented Cybertruck, which was packed with fireworks and fuel canisters, dramatically burst into flames. Seven people suffered minor injuries from what the FBI now believes was an intentional explosion. Leivelsberger was a decorated active duty special operations soldier attaining the rank of master sergeant in the U.S. Army. From 2017 to 2019, he served three tours of duty in Afghanistan. Before that, he was deployed to the Republic of Congo, Ukraine, and Tajikistan. Leivelsberger was on leave from his base in Germany and rented the Tesla on December 28th in Colorado Springs. FBI Special Agent Spencer Evans says investigators are still searching for a motive.
We know we have a bombing, absolutely, and it's a bombing that certainly has factors that raise concern. It's not lost on us that it's in front of, you know, of the Trump building, that it's a Tesla vehicle, but we don't have information at this point that definitively tells us or suggests it was because of this particular ideology or the, you know, any of the reasoning behind it.
The FBI says it hasn't found any association between the Cybertruck explosion and the attack in New Orleans earlier on New Year's Day. Both men served in the U.S. Army, including overlapping assignments at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, but there's no evidence that they knew each other. We'll have more on both of these stories after headlines. On Capitol Hill, the 119th U.S. Congress is opening today with Republicans control of both the House and the Senate. For the first time ever, the U.S. Senate will have two black women serving at the same time. Angela Alsobrooks of Maryland and Lisa Blunt Rochester from Delaware, both Democrats. Republicans will hold 53 Senate seats, Democrats 47. The U.S. House will swear in its first ever openly transgender lawmaker, Sarah McBride, a Democrat from Delaware. But the fate of the House speakership remains uncertain as of late Thursday, as Speaker Mike Johnson can only afford to lose one Republican vote as his party holds a slim 219 to 215 majority in the chamber. Some Republicans fear a protracted battle for House Speaker could delay the certification of Donald Trump's Electoral College victory, which is scheduled for Monday. Meanwhile, House Democrats are accusing Republicans of, quote, doubling down on their extremism, unquote, as they introduced a new rule that would only allow Republican lawmakers to force a vote on removing the House Speaker. Other proposals in the Republican Party's rules package include fast-tracking crackdowns on transgender rights, immigrants' rights, and abortion rights, dissolving the Congressional Diversity and Inclusion Office, renaming the Office of Congressional Ethics the Office of Congressional Conduct, and a bill that would sanction the International Criminal Court. President Biden Thursday awarded former Republican Congressmember Liz Cheney a Presidential Citizens Medal for her work on the House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Democratic Congressmember Benny Thompson, who chaired the House committee, also received the award. Trump has threatened to retaliate against Cheney and Thompson, saying they should go to jail. Among the other 18 presidential citizen awardees was Mitsui Endo Tsutsumi, who received a posthumous recognition for challenging the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. A federal appeals court has struck down the Federal Communications Commission's net neutrality rules, which prevented internet service providers from throttling, blocking, or charging more for certain content. Net neutrality rules, which proponents say are critical to maintaining an open internet, were reinstated last year by the Biden administration after they were gutted by Trump's FCC chair, Ajit Pai, in 2018. But the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled Thursday the FCC lacked authority to regulate broadband internet as a utility, citing the Supreme Court's overturning in June of the Chevron Doctrine, a 40-year-old legal precedent that gave deference to government agencies over lower courts in interpreting laws and imposing regulations. Digital rights groups and FCC Chair Jessica Rosenworcel are urging lawmakers to take action to restore net neutrality through congressional action. Two Biden administration officials say the president has decided to block the $15 billion takeover of U.S. Steel by the Japanese company Nippon Steel on national security grounds. The sale is opposed by unions, including United Steelworkers, who support Biden won in 2020 after he pledged to oppose the merger. China has sanctioned dozens of U.S. weapons makers, the latest escalation of the U.S.-China trade war before Donald Trump takes office. On Thursday, China announced it had added 28 U.S. companies to an export control list and blacklisted 10 other U.S. companies from doing business in China, citing weapons sales to Taiwan. Among the affected companies are General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon. On Tuesday, Chinese President Xi Jinping delivered his annual New Year's address, saying China's economy remains on course to expand by 5% in this year, despite Trump's threats of a renewed U.S.-China trade war.
The Chinese economy faces some new conditions, including challenges of uncertainties in the external environment and pressures of transformation from old growth drivers into new ones. But we can prevail with our hard work.
In South Korea, authorities suspended their attempt to arrest the impeached president Yoon Suk-yeol after a dramatic six-hour standoff with Yoon's supporters and his security forces. A court issued the arrest warrant for him earlier this week following his short-lived attempt to impose martial law last month. The warrant's valid until January 6. Yoon Suk-yeol's impeachment proceedings are set to start on January 14. At least 27 people died Thursday in two shipwrecks off the coast of Tunisia. One of the dead was a newborn baby. 83 surviving refugees from various sub-Saharan African countries were rescued by members of the Tunisian National Guard. Separately, at least 20 asylum seekers went missing Tuesday after their boat sank as it traveled from Libya to Italy. Authorities believe the passengers, which included women and children, died in the tragedy. The International Organization for Migration says at least 24,500 people have disappeared or died in the central Mediterranean since 2014 as they attempted to reach European shores. Most of the refugee boats set sail from Libya or Tunisia. And President Biden is preparing to designate two new national monuments in California ahead of Donald Trump's return to power. The Chuckwalla Monument, located next to the Joshua Tree National Park between the Colorado River and Coachella Valley, would create the largest contiguous protected area in the U.S. Biden's reportedly also announcing protections for the Satitla National Monument in Northern California near Oregon, which the Pitt River Tribe has been fighting to shield from energy development. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with what we know about the two apparent attacks that unfolded in the U.S. on New Year's Day and the response so far. The FBI has identified the driver of the Tesla Cybertruck that exploded outside the Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas Wednesday morning as 37-year-old Matthew Leivelsberger of Colorado Springs. He died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head moments before his rented car, packed with fireworks and fuel canisters, burst into flames, injuring seven. Leivelsberger was an active duty member of the Army. He was a Green Beret and Special Forces Master Sergeant. From 2017 to 2019, he served three tours of duty in Afghanistan. Before that, he deployed to the Republic of Congo, Ukraine, and Tajikistan. Leivelsberger was on leave from his base in Germany. FBI Special Agent Spencer Evans said Thursday investigators are still searching for a motive.
We know we have a bombing, absolutely, and it's a bombing that certainly has factors that raise concern. It's not lost on us that it's in front of, you know, of the Trump building, that it's a Tesla vehicle, but we don't have information at this point that definitively tells us or suggests it was because of this particular ideology or the, you know, any of the reasoning behind it.
The FBI says it has not found a link between the Las Vegas man and the suspect in the New Orleans attack earlier, just a few hours earlier on New Year's Day. Both men served in the U.S. Army, including overlapping assignments at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, what it used to be called. But there's no evidence they knew each other. President Biden Wednesday said the FBI had named 42-year-old Texas-born U.S. citizen, U.S. Army veteran Shamsuddin Jabbar as the suspect who rammed his pickup truck into throngs of revelers on Bourbon Street early Wednesday, killing 14.
I've directed them to keep looking. The individual who ran at the truck to explode that exploded in Las Vegas also served as active duty U.S. Army. And the FBI is working with the Department of Defense on investigating, including the service members' possible motives and all those he worked with.
Jabbar had posted five videos to social media in the last few hours before the attack, pledging allegiance to ISIS and discussing plans to kill his family. Both Jabbar and Leivelsberger were divorced. CNN reports Jabbar's second wife had a restraining order against him during their divorce case. Meanwhile, in recent months, Leivelsberger had reportedly removed pictures of himself from Facebook in which he proposed to his partner and cradled his newborn baby in his arms. On Thursday, President-elect Donald Trump blamed what he called Biden's open borders policy for, quote, radical Islamic terrorism, an apparent reference to the New Orleans attack. President Trump said once again that people coming from outside of the country were more dangerous than people at home. Soon after, President Biden said that the Texas man was a U.S.-born Army veteran. Meanwhile, Trump's incoming senior director for counterterrorism, Sebastian Gorka, also responded to the New Orleans attack. Gorka advised Trump in his first term, but was pushed out after The Forward revealed he once had ties to a Hungarian far-right Nazi-allied group and that he supported an anti-Semitic racist paramilitary militia in Hungary while he served as a Hungarian politician. Gorka spoke on the right-wing news outlet Newsmax.
You need to understand, every single one of our Newsmax viewers, you are on the front line of the war against global jihadism. It's not just our tier one operators. It's not just the guys at Damn Neck, the SEALs, or the guys over the wire at Bragg. You, like the people on Bourbon Street, are on the front line. So be aware, keep your head on a swivel. And if you hear people doing strange things, acting peculiarly, apparently this individual converted to Islam last year, you right. need to also share that information.
For more, we're joined by Mike Prysner, an Iraq War Army veteran who's been watching these developments closely. He previously co-founded March Forward, an anti-war group of veterans and active service members, and worked with Veterans for Peace and another group called About Face. He still works as a GI organizer. Michael Prysner joined the U.S. Army in 2001 when he was 17 and left the military in 2005. His company participated in the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, where he served for a year. He hosts a podcast for service members called Eyes Left. In June, his report for the Empire Files was headlined "Dozens Quitting U.S. Military Over Gaza in Protest, Voices of Hidden Unrest Within the Ranks." Mike Prysner, welcome to Democracy Now! Thank you for joining us from Portland, Oregon. If you can start off by responding to these two attacks. Now, again, the Authorities say they see no connection between the two. They think both men acted alone. They did use the same app to rent their cars. Leivelsberger rented in Denver an EV, one of those Tesla cyber trucks, which looks like a tank. And you have Jabbar, who launched this attack in New Orleans, used his car as a weapon, his EV pickup truck. Both men were in the military. You have Leivelsberger, a Green Beret, and you have Jabbar, who was in the military for more than a decade, now a military veteran. Talk about what took place on New Year's, Mike.
Right. Well, both of these incidents and individuals seem quite different, other than the fact that both of them seem to be triggered by relationship issues. But the main thing that links them is the fact that military service is now the number one predictor of becoming what is called a mass casualty offender, surpassing even mental health issues as a profiler. You know, there are many different consequences of having a massive military empire, the biggest humanity has ever seen, both in its sheer size, its expanse around the world, one that is constantly engaged in endless and morally indefensible wars around the world. And one of those consequences is the violence abroad coming back against people at home. Leivelsberger, of course, his career was one of killing. And then, you know, the New Orleans attacker says he was inspired by ISIS. The mass killing ideology of ISIS. ISIS would not exist were it not for the U.S. military's complete destruction of Iraq and mass killing of innocent people. You know, America in general, of course, has a mass violence problem. Mass shootings happen quite regularly, more than once a day on average. And that the reasons for that are linked to U.S. militarism, both in that kind of cultural domination of a country that glorifies violence and exports violence, but more so a government that is presiding over a country with deep and extreme social problems, which it refuses to address while having a blank and endless check for militarism abroad and an ever-increasing budget for the military-industrial complex. And so this gives rise to an extreme amount of social problems in our society that are rooted in things like alienation and inequality and desperation and despair and hopelessness. And then so the U.S. military comes in and for the purposes of recruitment must target people who are most impacted by those social problems. They bring them into an institution where they train them to kill. They train them that killing is actually quite honorable and quite cool. It sends many of those people to kill abroad. You know, it has a notoriously, very notorious for ruining people's mental health and a mental health system that makes people's mental health problems even worse, and then spits them back out into a society where people find their lives harder than when they join. That's kind of why I think that has become a number one predictor of becoming a mass casualty offender, is all of those consequences. And, you know, we look at Fort Bragg in particular. You mentioned both these people passed through Fort Bragg. You know, Fort Bragg was, for two decades, the hub of the global war on terror, in particular the special operations factor, which does some pretty dark stuff around the world. And so it's really no surprise that two of these people passed through this base, and that they are just joining a larger number of people from the military who end up carrying out acts of violence on others. A lot of these are turned inward, and there's, of course, an epidemic of suicide and drug addiction and alcohol addiction and overdoses and things like that. But, of course, when you have a scenario like that in our society, some number of those people will, instead of self-destruction, will move to the destruction of others, which is what we've seen with these two individuals.
And again, Fort Bragg is now called Fort Liberty because Bragg was an enslaving Confederate general, Braxton Bragg, a Confederate officer in the U.S. Civil War, and like a number of bases, it has been renamed. You talk about the violence, also an epidemic of violence against women on these bases, and it's always interesting in these mass casualty events, whether you're talking about a mass shooter in a school like Sandy Hook, to look at the attacker's relationship with women in the past. I mean, you have the Sandy Hook shooter killed his mother before. But often when domestic violence doesn't go, isn't taken seriously, you see what the escalation of the violence, Mike.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and this is a problem that's endemic to the military as well. I mean, you know, Fort Liberty, it's high rates of domestic violence, of murders even. You know, Seth Harp, who's another anti-war Iraq war veteran, has also done really important work on this. And so, yes, I mean, there is, of course, many indicators. I mean, it comes back to this idea that we have this mass violence problem. There are many ways that the government could be stopping this, could be taking measures to get to the root of these things, but instead it just exacerbates them. And of course, the U.S. military is, you know, there's so many cocktails in our society that allow these things to bubble over into violence against other people. The military is just, you know, one of the stronger cocktails that exists.
And let's talk about Leivelsberger, what we understand now happened. He's the Green Beret who drove that Cybertruck that blew up in front of the Trump Hotel in Las Vegas. Apparently, he died of a self-inflicted bullet wound. Can you talk about soldier suicides?
Well, I mean, it's an epidemic, and it has been for a long time. I mean, it's something that, you know, especially was exacerbated when the Iraq and Afghanistan wars began. You have people like Leivelsberger who, you know, deployed many, many, many times in special operations. You know, he no doubt was involved in things that involved in killing all over the world. But, you know, the way that the military historically, and, you know, from my own experience, you know, being in touch with so many service members who were struggling against this, you know, that the military's policy when it comes to mental health and suicide and things like that is to maintain the fighting force. And so the goal of the U.S. military when they're dealing with you know, this epidemic and within their ranks is to keep the fighting force active and keeping people deploying and things like that. And that's what we saw throughout the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so, of course, there's a great deal of this in society writ large. But in the military in particular, you know, so Leivelsberger, who injured many people and could have killed some people as well. And so, you know, on face value, it looks like, you know, he was just another statistic of someone from special operations or the military in general that killed themselves, but, you know, was doing it in this kind of spectacular way. You know, went out with a bang, which, you know, that with our corporate media that sensationalizes so many of these incidents, you know, maybe was inspired to do something that, you know, made a scene or something like that. But I think the suicide is, of course, a major problem in the military and in our society for the reasons that I mentioned earlier. And that, you know, there's going to be some layer of those people that, you know, want to turn that violence on other people as well as themselves.
An article in the Washington Post from about a month ago is headlined, "Trump Could Hobble Renewed Fight Against Domestic Terrorism, Analysts Warned." Now, this is really interesting. I remember when Obama came to office and there was a report on domestic terrorism, especially right-wing terrorism in the military. He was pressured not to have that report released. This is an ongoing issue. Then you have the misinformation that Fox put out on New Year's Day saying that the truck that was rented came over. This is the truck in New Orleans that Jabbar used, came over the border in the last 2 days. It was not minutes later that Trump didn't post on Truth Social that finally people have to accept that people who come from outside this country are more of a threat than people who are born here. And he attributed the minimizing of foreign threat to Democrats and the fake news media. Of course, he was wrong about this, and Jabbar was a U.S.-born, U.S. citizen, served in the military for more than 10 years. Mike?
Of course. Well, you know, the Trump administration is going to use the New Orleans attacker to, you know, feed into their right-wing agenda. The reality is that when we look at extremist attacks or violence from people who have been in the military or are still in the military, a very, very tiny number of those people you could say were inspired by Islamic extremism. But right-wing extremism is, in fact, a very prevalent and common thing and has been throughout the entire history of the U.S. military. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan, America's premier domestic terrorist organization, organization was one founded by military veterans. And throughout the entire history of the U.S. military, white supremacists and right-wing organizations have heavily recruited from and, you know, been led by people who are in the military and military veterans as well. This all came to a head in the 90s, where the Oklahoma City bombing, but also you had neo-Nazi service members
in
the Marines commit a lynching of a black couple in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And then so there was this brief period of crackdown of the military on right-wing extremism, but when the Iraq War started going very badly and they needed bodies to continue to go to the Iraq War, they completely removed their restrictions on this kind of thing, and then, you know, which has been exposed by many journalists, were knowingly bringing in right-wing extremists, some of whom were going into the military specifically to get training to bring back out into their organizations. And so today we have many far-right organizations like Adam Waffen Division, Identity Europa, Patriot Front, people, some of those organizations founded by veterans, but also who recruit heavily from the military and veterans as well. Like, leaked documents from Patriot Front show that more than 20% of their applicants are young veterans or people who are still in the military. You know, this is a real danger. You know, the Oath Keepers, you know, this after January 6th, it was revealed that so many of the participants were military veterans. In fact, many from the special operations were really the tactical leadership of that assault, and many of whom had staffed large numbers of assault rifles and ammunition in hotel rooms that were very near the Capitol assault. And so, of course, this is a something that should concern everyone. It's obviously, you know, the real clear and present danger when we're talking about extremism from within the military. But the Trump administration has indicated that the problem in the military is, in fact, wokeism. And they may be, you know, be going after woke generals and or things like that, which really means they will be going after trans people. But also, I think it's very concerning when we talk about what we should look forward to with the Trump administration, how they're going to combat extremism from the military. You know, one of Trump's main program platforms on his 20-point program for his presidency, one of them was deporting pro-Hamas terrorists. And so, of course, we know that the Trump administration, when they say pro-Hamas, they really just mean pro-Palestine. And, you know, this, I guess, you know, brings me to the point that, you know, the military, as we've been discussing, really transforms people. In a lot of ways, it can tend to transform people in extremely negative ways. But a lot of times, people's military experience puts them in a positive direction and causes them to reject the violence that they were a part of, which is what we've been seeing the past year through the Gaza genocide, where large numbers of service members have been quitting the military, both publicly and privately, have been taking part in demonstrations to try to protest the U.S. role in it, and taking other really dramatic and heroic actions in that regard. And those are the kinds of people that Donald Trump and Hegseth and others who are going to be a part of the administration identify as extremists, when the real threat of right-wing extremism is going to go, of course, completely ignored, because, you know, that's really the base of the incoming administration.
Finally, Mike Preisner, a recent Guardian report headlined Trump pick a threat to U.S. military's counter-extremism effort. Experts warned, quote, Pete Hegseth, Donald Trump's embattled choice for Secretary of Defense, will struggle to handle the serious problem of extremism in the U.S. military due to his own far-right political views. Experts in the subject have warned. The piece quotes Christopher Goldsmith, an Iraq War veteran, CEO of the nonprofit watchdog Task Force Butler, saying, quote, I think it's going to be an absolute disaster. Pete Hegseth is a domestic extremist, he said. The Guardian goes on to note, quote, Hegseth, an Iraq and Afghan war veteran, was barred from attending Joe Biden's 2021 inauguration after a fellow National Guardsman accused him of being an insider threat and an extremist with problematic tattoos. Mike Preisner, your final comments.
Yeah, well, we are in a tumultuous time in America, both a time of heightened political violence and at a time of growing despair and growing inequality in this country. You know, the military, being a cross-section of that U.S. society, experiences those things as well. And in that moment, there are going to be numbers of people in the military and veterans who are going to gravitate towards right-wing organizations and go the path that Hegseth went. There's going to be people who do the opposite, and there's going to be people that just turn inward into self-destruction and despair. And so that's why I think it's very important for progressive-minded people, you know, to realize that there is a role we can play in reaching out to people who are in the military, who can go down a different path and could go down the path of the many heroic service members who have taken a stand, who have have quit the military and who have used their experiences as a force for good in this world. And, you know, getting back to this main issue of that we have these deep-rooted problems in our society that give rise to these incidents of mass violence, you know, service members and veterans, you know, instead of being a number one mass casualty offender, so many of them can actually be a part of changing society and getting to the root of those issues and moving society forward as they have historically in the past. Vietnam veterans leading the struggle against the Vietnam War, Iraq veterans leading the struggle against the Iraq War, and in both those incidents being decisive factors in those wars coming to an end. We have much bigger problems to address in society. Service members can be, and veterans can very much be, a part of solving them. And it's very much needed that we foster that among progressive people, because there is clearly a faction on the right wing that is very much already doing that and taking advantage of that. And of course, is entering the highest seats of power with people like Hegseth.
Mike Prajzner, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Mike was an Iraq War Army veteran, longtime GI organizer, previously co-founded March Forward, an anti-war group of veterans and active service members. He was 17 when he joined the military in 2001. His company participated in the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, three films directed by Palestinians are shortlisted for the Academy Awards. We'll look at one of them, From Ground Zero. Stay with us. Go to the army, be all you could be. Another dead soldier, hell no, not me. So I start letting off ammunition in every direction. Allah is my only protection. But wait a minute, Saddam Hussein prays the same. And this is Asia, from where I came. I'm on the wrong side, so change the target. Shooting at the general, and where's the sergeant? Blame it on John Horty Hawk for bringing me to America. Now it's mass hysteria. I get a rush when I see blood, dead bodies on the floor. Casualties of war. Casualties of war. Casualties of war. Casualties of war. The war is over, for now at least. Just because they lost, it don't mean it's peace. It's a long way home, it's a lot to think about. Whole generation left in doubt. Innocent families killed in the mist. It'll be more dead people activists. So I'm glad to be alive and walking. Half of my patrol came home in coffin. Except the general buried in the storm. And bits and pieces, no need to look for them. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. That was Casualties of War by Eric B. and Rakim. We turn now to Gaza, where Israel continues to intensify its attacks, killing at least 35 Palestinians since dawn. Authorities report more than 70 killings over the last 24 hours, including in Al-Mawasi, a region that Israel designated a so-called humanitarian safe zone. As Israel's relentless war on Gaza enters its 15th month, we turn now to a film that's been shortlisted for this year's Oscars, From Ground Zero, a collection of 22 short films made in Gaza by Palestinian filmmakers surviving Israel's bombings. This is the film's trailer.
Isn't this tragic?
As you can see, we're picking up flour and sand. That's all we have left to do. We pick up whatever we find on the ground. We have to eat.
22 extraordinary stories.
There are always drones making a buzzing sound. They are always above our heads when we sleep, study, dance.
From 22 Palestinian filmmakers.
Mom wrote on my arm, if they bomb us and kill us, we'll be identified from our names written on our bodies.
Living through war.
I was targeted 3 times in 24 hours. The first time, my cousin and I were returning from Camp 5. They attacked the house and we were buried in the wreckage.
Musab, who's next to you? Khalid? Is he dead?
Yes.
Believe me, my friend, I had a beautiful life in a beautiful city.
We want to laugh, rejoice, sing, and express our emotions. Yes, there are bombings and destruction and many other things that take us back to zero. But that only increases our challenge to overcome.
Today, I want to tell you a story. Are you ready?
Our greatest loss was not being able to see the film in front of the audience on the big screen.
No to injustice, no to violence, no to the violation of human rights. No to everything that goes against humanity, joy, life. No to everything that destroys our hopes.
That's the trailer for From Ground Zero, which has been shortlisted for the 2025 Oscars, along with two other Palestinian films, No Other Land and An Orange from Jaffa. The film is being released nationwide in the United States today. It made news recently when the acclaimed documentary filmmaker Michael Moore, Oscar-winning filmmaker Michael Moore, joined as executive producer. We go now to France, where we're joined by Rachid Masharawi, renowned Palestinian filmmaker originally from Gaza, who curated and directed From Ground Zero. This is an astounding collection, Rachid. I spent the night watching it and then watching it again. It is so deeply moving. Explain, not often do you see a director called the curator. Explain what you did.
Hi. Usually as a film director from Gaza, usually I am doing my own film. But this time for me, the situation was different. The images was different. The size of the massacre, the killing. We never witnessed something like this. So then I decided, okay, my coming film or my next film will be made by filmmakers from Gaza, just to give the chance to 22 filmmakers to tell their own stories, their own daily life, to get closer to the details, because I believe these people must share their own stories with the world. At the same time, you know, we are filmmakers. We are trying to make cinema, to deal with art, with culture, in spite of all what happened. We were trying to search for hope. Yes.
I want to go to another clip. We played the trailer, but this is a clip of the short film Sorry Cinema, featured in From Ground Zero, where the director Ahmed Hassouna is fleeing for his life after an Israeli strike near his home in Gaza.
Now my life has become a different kind of marathon. Now I am running to save my family's lives, my own life. I run, hoping to find food and drink for my children, who flee the bombings from one house to another.
Ahmad!
Ahmad, are you okay? Where are you? Get out of there. Are you okay? Come.
I struggle to endure the things I see and hear. Everything that is happening to us, everything we are going through. I have just lost my older brother in a random bombing next to his house. What? The whole tower collapsed. At that moment, I felt death catching up with us. Our only chance of survival was luck. Our only chance of escaping the rubble, the bombing houses, the ruins of the city. Nowhere in Gaza is safe, especially in the north, where I currently live. Here, no humanitarian aid, nor rescue, nor civil protection arrives. All that comes are bombs, fear, stress, and insecurity.
Talk about Ahmed Hassouna's story, Rachid.
Yes, Ahmed, he was known in Gaza before the war. He's a cinephile. He's all his life spent after watching film, searching about films, trying to make films in Gaza, from Gaza. And all the time he was looking for an opportunity to make his new film. During the war, I contacted Ahmed and I told him, join me in my project From Ground Zero. Be one of these filmmakers. This is your chance, because I'm going to show these films internationally and worldwide. And immediately he said, no, I don't want to make a film, Rashid. He said, I am trying to save my family. I am searching for wood to make a fire, to cook for the family. We are moving every day to from one place to another. And just a few days ago, I lost my older brother. So I don't want to make a film. Sorry for you. Sorry for the cinema, Rashid. And I was shocked from his answer because I know his love to cinema. And then 2-3 weeks later, I get back to him and I say, Ahmed, let's make what you told me in our conversation. Let's make a film about a filmmaker from Gaza. He have no time to make cinema because he's trying to save his life. Show us something from your previous films. Show us your daily life and show us how you are going to make it to say sorry for the cinema. And then we agree and we come with this film, the one that everybody watching now, Sorry Cinema. I think people must know, beside all these people whose martyrs we talk about, it's been more than 50,000 now. Most of them are innocent. Most of them are people who are really searching for life. People like Ahmed Hassouna, he want to be a filmmaker. And from ground zero, we have many people want to be a painter, want to be stand-up comedy. They want to be a dancers. See, people like any other people in the world trying to manage their own dreams. And I was interested in these people to tell the stories, the normal stories, the real life under all this massacre and genocide.
You were born and raised in Gaza, Rashid Mashirawi. Through the making of this film, you also witnessed the destruction of your home, your reflections as you try to encourage these filmmakers. They'd be in the middle of a film, they'd lose a family member, they'd lose many members of their family, talking to you about not being able to go on.
Yeah. Yes, it means for me, it was logical and normal that I will be involved in from ground zero as a Gazaian. All my family are in Gaza now. And as you say, we lost many people from my family and we lost our houses. I lost all the neighborhood where all my memory, my school, my childhood games, friends for sure, neighbors for sure, and many things. But still, you know, I'm someone known as I always optimistic. I'm always adding hope. I believe in cinema, in art. I trust cinema, you know, because I think cinema should play the role that it's playing in from ground zero. Cinema for justice, you know, cinema for humanity, cinema just to remind the world all the time. We are all humans. We are the same. We have the same dreams. Many people was killed because they were in Gaza at this location at this time. And they have nothing to do with what's going on. Women and kids and old people. Okay. We know what happened in 7 October. We know when Hamas get out and they attack and they hostage people and they kill people and they arrest people. Me, myself, I know also many, many massacres that the Israelis did before 7 October. This struggle, it started more than 77 years ago, before 1948. And we have, as Palestinians, we have to keep telling our stories. We have to fight to make good cinema also and to share all these stories with the world. I am very happy that these films are now crossing the U.S., showing in many cinemas. And I will be very happy when many people just go and watch, because it's not news. It's not a reportage. It has something else. It has nothing to do with politics even. It has something to do with our world that we are all sharing. We are looking for justice.
Rashid Mashirawi, yes, the film is opening today in cinemas across the country. It's also gotten headlines because the award-winning filmmaker, Oscar-winning filmmaker Michael Moore, has joined you as executive producer. Now, he won the Palme d'Or for the documentary film Fahrenheit 9/11, becoming the first and only documentary to win there. Your film was accepted at Cannes, where he won the Palme d'Or, but then rejected? And what did you do?
I think our films were from the beginning rejected. I mean, we never was accepted in Cannes. We were in discussing with Cannes to try to show even not all from Ground Zero, some films from Ground Zero, because I was coming with to Cannes with films and filmmakers, you know. And I think they don't want to deal with us. Even they say it in the press conference of Cannes before the festival. They don't want to deal with the tension, with the political, with all what's happening in the area. It was only Gaza. It was only Palestine. I mean, I remember 2 years before, when the president of Ukraine was having space in the opening of Cannes making speech.
Right, that was President Zelensky.
Yes, it was also to deal with the war and to deal with politics. You know, I feel sorry for Cannes Film Festival because I consider Cannes Film Festival, it's an important festival, good festival, big festival. It should make his job. It should play his role to give space, to give stage to filmmakers and to cinema and to protect humanity through cinema, through art, through filmmakers. And they didn't. I think they lost the opportunity to be. It means they were there and we were also there. So I say then, if Cannes don't want to go to Gaza, Gaza will go to Cannes. So I take my team, I build our tents in Cannes, like the tents in Rafah, exactly. We have our own screenings, our own sound, our own audience, and we make our own films. We make the people from Gaza to speak, the filmmakers, to speak inside Cannes with the audience. And we bring Gaza to Cannes during the festival. But officially, we were not in Cannes.
Rashid, we just have a minute. So to clarify, it wasn't originally accepted at Cannes. But it is premiering here in the United States across the country. You partnered with Watermelon Pictures, the first distribution company for Palestinian films in the U.S. We have 30 seconds. The significance of this collaboration.
I am really, really proud, you know, with what they are doing, Watermelon. I feel that I already won the Oscar because my aim is to show these films to maximum people. And this is what Watermelon is doing. They are showing these films everywhere. And also the input, what Michael Moore bring to these films. It's really to join us and to share the stories with many, many, many people. I just can appreciate and thank with all, from all my heart for all these people who participate and help and support from Ground Zero.
Rashid Masharawi, I want to thank you for being with us, renowned Palestinian filmmaker from Gaza. He curated the Oscar shortlisted From Ground Zero, being released in theaters nationwide in the United States today. Next up, an update on the impact of the bombing of Yemen. Stay with us.
And now it's the winner. She's like a winter in America.
Winter America by Gil Scott-Heron, Brian Jackson, and the Midnight Band, soul of the Midnight Band, and former Black Panther Bilal Sunni Ali passed away December 30th. It was said when he played his horn, he put fear in the oppressor and brought hope to the oppressed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Yemen as the Pentagon launched a wave of airstrikes on Sana'a and other parts of Yemen this week. U.S. Central Command said it targeted Houthi command and weapons production facilities. The attacks came just after Israel bombed the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah and the main airport in Sana'a, killing at least six people. For more, we're joined by Shireen Al-Adimi, the Yemeni-American assistant professor at Michigan State University and a non-resident fellow at Quincy Institute. Professor, welcome back to Democracy Now! As we just have a few minutes, if you can talk about the significance of the U.S. attacks and the Israeli attacks, one on the airport in Sana'a, as the head of the World Health Organization, Ghebreyesus, was getting on the plane.
Yeah, so as we know that the U.S. formed Operation Prosperity Guardian essentially to protect commercial ships and other vessels going through the Red Sea that the Houthis, also, of course, they're known as Ansarullah, have been rerouting in support of the Palestinians, given the genocide that's occurring in Gaza. And so the U.S. has moved their carriers, USS Truman and others, to the Red Sea and have been, launching airstrikes, what they're calling Houthi targets, which honestly is just a phrase that justifies and legitimizes the bombings. These are targets that are largely on civilian targets. You mentioned Sana'a International Airport, which is the only operating airport in northern Yemen, and the port city of Hodeidah, which, of course, is the lifeline of Yemen, which is still reeling from a decade of the U.S.-Saudi-UAE campaign, the war of aggression over the last 10 years. And then most recently, Israel has joined by striking these sites directly. And so these are strikes on Yemeni infrastructure. These are strikes on Yemeni civilians. They're aimed at deterring Ansarullah's capabilities because they have been supporting the Palestinians. But as we know, that the only thing that will stop Ansarullah from rerouting ships in the Red Sea and stopping their attacks, their drone and missile attacks in Israel, is an end to the genocide in Gaza and an end to the starvation of the Palestinian people.
If you could explain, as I mentioned, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus was just meters away from the blast when the Israeli bomb dropped at the airport. What was he doing in Yemen, Professor Adimi?
So he was in Yemen as part of a mission to try to release some World Health Organization employees who have been held by Ansarullah. And he said that the negotiations have been going very well, that they reached agreements on four major points. So that was the mission. And of course, this is public knowledge where the World Health Organization goes. This is a civilian airport. And it was known, he himself says, that he assumes that whoever needed to know where he was, that he was there in that location at that particular time, would have known. So it is not a coincidence that Israel targeted the airport while he was there, just meters away. As you mentioned, he still says that he suffers from tinnitus from the blast. There were six people who were killed, 40 Yemenis who were injured. So this is a really significant development that, honestly, I'm pretty shocked that it's not more widely known and reported on. It just seemed to have disappeared in the news. The targeting of the World Health Organization's Secretary General, essentially, and I would say targeting is the appropriate word, because, like I said, they would have known that he was there at the time. So I think it sends a message to the World Health Organization to, maybe they don't know why he was there, but Israel can apparently do no wrong. So this is not surprising that they've gotten away with doing what they've done in Palestine and Yemen, bombing their neighbors across the Middle East. And yet, they're given the green light to commit these atrocities and to target whomever they want, to target Yemeni infrastructure, to target an airport that only functions really to Amman and back, a couple of flights each week, and all because they want to continue doing what they're doing in Palestine with no consequences.
Professor, President Trump is about to become president again in just over 2 weeks. Do you expect U.S. policy towards Yemen to change?
I don't, because for the past 22 years, a U.S. president has been bombing Yemen, starting with the Bush administration, continuing on with Obama, who expanded the drone campaign and then launched the, you know, full support for the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen from 2015 to the end of his presidency. Then we had Trump, who just continued selling weapons to the Saudis and supporting their war every step of the way. Then President Biden said that he would end the war in Yemen, but really just continued supporting them, but just under a rebranding, essentially, as a defensive rather than an offensive war. And now Biden is directly bombing Yemen. And so I don't expect U.S. policy in Yemen to change. I expect Yemenis to continue doing what they can to defend themselves. But unfortunately, we've seen over the last 22 years that the U.S. will continue to break its own laws. It's unconstitutional to attack another country without congressional approval. And honestly, what is Congress doing while all of these presidents have been attacking? So unfortunately, I don't expect policy to change, but this should not be accepted. This should not be normalized. And we as citizens should be doing everything we can to stop it.
We have to leave it there. Professor Shireen Aladimi, thank you so much for joining us. A happy birthday to Dennis McCormick and Clara Ibarra. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Quilt is a literary publication for and by undergraduate students here at Queens.
If you're interested in the fantastic minds of your peers, check us out on Instagram at QUQuilt to read our volumes of creative and academic writing.
Stay tuned for more information about our upcoming launch event.
Love, Quilt. I should unwalk out the door, drag my feet along the floor. Then I see you, you're walking across the campus, cool professor studying romances.